Hello, I'm Doug Nadvornik, pleased to bring you the first official installment of the Inland Journal, Spokane Public Radio's new weekly half-hour public affairs program. It's been a treat to walk through Riverfront Park the last week or so and hear the power of Mother Nature. With all the water in our region right now, the chance of a wildfire starting and gaining traction somewhere is pretty remote. But the memories of the severe wildfire seasons of 2014 and 2015, speaking of the power of Mother Nature, are still fresh in the minds of Washington elected leaders. Last week, Governor Jay Inslee, Lands Commissioner Hillary Franz, and a few others met with Spokane landowners like Bonnie Cobb. They wanted to see the work these folks had done to keep their homes and property safe from wildfire.
This is one of our most successful firewise communities because we married great local leadership like Bonnie with a few dollars from the state and from the federal government. Great things can happen when you leverage all that mutual effort.
Lands Commissioner Franz says Washington has more than 140 firewise neighborhoods with a request in the state budget for $1 million to help another 80 get started.
We're making significant progress, and again, when I say we, I mean the agency certainly is a key factor in help in providing that funding, resourcing means, but the homegrown part of getting communities engaging on the ground in their own community, how to make themselves more resilient, has been so helpful.
It's that idea, making land more resistant to wildfires, that's driving support for two forest health bills that are moving through the Washington legislature. The bills are sponsored by two eastern Washington legislators, Wenatchee Republican Senator Brad Hawkins and Okanagan County Republican Representative Joel Kretz. But even urban legislators, such as Democratic Representative Larry Springer, have signed on. Springer's district includes the East Side Seattle suburbs, but he has personal reasons for supporting the bills. About 50 years ago, he, his father, and brother built a cabin between Lake Wenatchee and Leavenworth that's still in the family.
My family has faced evacuations twice from our cabin near those fires. And it occurs to us that this is going to be a syndrome that we're going to face for years to come. We cannot continue to come down here to Olympia year after year and write bigger and bigger checks in order to put out fires. We need to build forests that are resilient.
The wildfire policy advisor for the Department of Natural Resources says the state has, over the last 6 years, spent $400 million to battle wildfires, but only $20 million to prevent them.
We need a shift in thinking when it comes to wildfire, a shift from being reactive about wildfire to being proactive.
Senator Brad Hawkins' bill aims to treat 1 million acres of forests during the next 6 years. That means cutting trees when the density makes them susceptible to quickly moving fires. It means prescribed burns to clear out fuel. It means creating fire breaks that can stop fires from spreading. And it means keeping track of the work that's done. Representative Kretz's legislation directs the Department of Natural Resources to identify forested state trust lands that are most in need of treatment over the next generation. It would require 2-year and 6-year project lists.
This is an attempt to get a little bit more strategic in how we're doing it. We've got millions of acres that need treatment. A lot of them are extremely unhealthy, and we're trying to get looking out a little bit further into the future on how do we plan that. And then with it on a schedule, I think we've got a little bit more accountability on the back end so the legislature sees what we're getting for the buck.
Both bills have moved through their houses of origin without dissenting votes. Hawkins' bill was voted out of a House committee today. Kretz's bill has received a hearing in a Senate committee. Both say their bills are complementary, not competitive with each other. And now we're joined on the phone by Joel Kretz, who cites two examples of what he considers best practices in protecting land from fire.
You know, I think the best example on the state of what we should be doing is the Sinlahiken Wildlife Refuge. And they have had an active thinning and prescribed burn program for about 15 years. And I actually took a fellow legislator out there right after the Okanagan complex in 2015. It was still smoking, and you drive through about 15 miles of moonscape, and you get out there and you can see where the fires came down the canyon, crowning out, taking everything, and then they hit that refuge where the forest has been properly treated, and it drops down to the ground and everything's green. So a lot of it's education. We've got to move toward that model, and I'll just give you one other real-life example. in 2015, Okanagan Complex, I started getting calls from people that were upset that, you know, the fire was coming, and they put in a fire line up Aeneas Valley, and their houses were in between the line and the fire, and they were worried. And I went down and talked to the incident commander, and he said, okay, so here's the deal. We know those houses are there. We'll get structure people out there and try and save them if it comes. But this is an area where we put the line that had thinning done. It was a joint effort between the feds, the state, and private landowners where they had thinned a long belt of forest land and thinned it out and then done some prescribed burning. He said it's the only place in that whole country we can stop a fire, that we've got any chance without losing firefighters or just wasting our time because the forest has been treated. So I'm just pushing toward that model. And part of this bill is, you know, let's be strategic. You know, we need to identify the biggest benefit for the buck on treating forest land. But we also have to be thinking about putting those barriers in. You know, typically the model has been you try and keep them out of the town and then it burns all the way to the next town. Well, why don't we stop it somewhere in between if we can? And that's kind of the push on this bill is let's get those strategic areas mapped out and try and do it on a kind of an effort with bringing different landowners in to where we can get, say, a quarter mile wide band, you know, going 30, 40 miles that would strategically stop a fire.
How is your bill different from Senator Hawkins' bill?
Well, Senator Hawkins' bill is a little broader. Mine is focused on our state forests, and his cover is private, state, and federal, which is actually it's good timing. We just signed a good neighbor agreement with the Forest Service recently. The DNR did so. He's got a broader landscape that he's looking at. Probably the biggest difference is that I've got a revolving fund built into mine to where they can accept money from the state, the feds, an NGO, whoever, to get it rolling, and then it revolves. They go out and treat acres, and if there's revenue that comes off it, some of these areas they're going to actually make some money on. It goes back into the fund, and then it goes right back out, and we can do more acres, kind of a self-perpetuating program.
So you're not constantly having to go back to Olympia and say, I need some more money from my
exactly.
program.
Exactly. Yeah, we're trying to self-fund it a little bit.
One of the unusual things about this legislation is that it has no real opposition. Listen to the people who have testified in favor of the two bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Jason Callahan from the Washington Forest Protection Association, signing in pro on this bill.
My name is Matt Comiskey. I'm the Washington manager for American Forest Resource Council.
Those are names you would expect to hear supporting this bill. These you might be surprised by.
Mitch Friedman. I direct Conservation Northwest out of Seattle.
For the record, my name is Scott Richards. I'm testifying on behalf of the Nature Conservancy.
So one of the things I've noticed, and having covered forest issues for 20 or 25 years, is that in past years, the environmental groups would complain that, hey, you're going to go out there and you're going to cut trees, but it's just an excuse to go out and cut trees. And I just don't get the sense that that's the argument this year. Why do you think you've had the consensus from conservation groups this year?
Well, I've worked with them. I think the Nature Conservancy is a good example. You know, I mean, they were in a big acquisition mode for many, many years. They're huge landowners now, and they're watching it all burn up or just stand there in poor health and be at risk. And they've actually been great partners on this. But you hit it. I mean, the fear has always been it's just an excuse to go logging. And it's been education. I mean, I had that tour of the Sinlahican. I had Hans Dunshee, West Side legislator, who's got probably a pretty good tree hugger sort of a reputation. But seeing's believing. You know, when you see a landscape that looks like the moon and then you walk into this area that has been treated, it looks good, it looks healthy, you can see that the focus is on forest health and not just an excuse for logging. And you know, I think they've also seen the model of whatever we're doing now is not working. I was in the timber industry it's, you know, I've considered those people my mortal enemies for 30 years, but there's we're getting some common ground, and I'm kind of encouraged that they're looking at it a different way now.
Joel Kretz is a Republican representative in Washington's 7th Legislative District. He's the prime sponsor of one of two forest health bills moving through the legislature. Our thanks to TVW for the sound in this story. Wednesday night at Spokane City Hall, Spokane Public Radio held its annual Health Forum. This year it focused on suicide awareness. My colleague Steve Jackson assembled a panel of guests, including mental health specialists, the chief of the Post Falls Police Department, and a board member from the group End of Life Washington. Steve joins me here for a quick recap. Now, I wasn't there last night, but I did see a Facebook photo that showed a pretty good crowd there. Why don't you tell me about the crowd?
Yeah, it was a good crowd. We were in the back room in the green room, and when we came out, I'd say that room, the city council chambers, may have been mostly full. The other thing that was good was there was quite a few good questions. I mean, I don't even know, you know, sometimes when we get in there if there's going to be a lot of good questions, but there were. There wasn't really anybody other than kind of my sub-panelists or kind of the surprise guest we had near the end that stood up to the microphone. We had a lot of people write down questions on cards. And, you know, even some of the questions were a little bit poignant, you know, because this is a pretty emotional topic. And the format was such that I had to read those things off a card. And one of them was somebody asking for specific advice, and they were very suicidal, and they, you know, it explained why they were and that they were taking medications and the like. And I was kind of surprised that I had to read that, because it was like, whoa, this is kind of emotional stuff.
You've mentioned some of the highlights that were there for you. Are there some other impressions you left with?
Well, there was a couple moments for me where it was a bit emotional, and reading that card was okay. I don't think anybody even noticed that, but I read it okay. And I was just thinking, wow, this is pretty important stuff. We may be actually helping someone who's in the building right now. And I'm not sure that the follow-up on that, because what one of the psychologist on our panel said, hey, let's meet afterward. But I did see that I was pretty sure he didn't meet with anyone else. However, one of our counselors on the panel mentioned, you know, you could call our office and here's how to get a hold of us at Frontier Health. And so I'm guessing, or I'm hoping, that person did, you know, follow through and got a hold of Stacy Cornwell, the counselor. So yeah, there was good stuff going on. There was a woman in the audience whose name was Cheryl, and we got to her through the counselor. She got up and spoke about her own battles with mental issues.
I would say recovery is possible. I live a full, meaningful life now. I have found treatments that work.
What were the most important things that helped you the most, do you think?
My family held hope for me when I didn't have it. The professional people in my life cared about me and held value and hope for me when I had none. Hopelessness is the hallmark of depression, and I had no hope. People loved me. People cared about me. People listened.
And she's actually gone on to help assist other counselors in talking to those who are considering taking their own life.
You had a pretty diverse panel. Why don't you tell me about some of the main themes that came up in the conversation?
We talked about, you know, the usual kind of things you'd expect to ask, like how do you counsel these people? And that was almost kind of difficult to describe because it could be case by case basis, you know. We talked about how do you counsel, what are the here's another one. I just thought of another one. This was good too. The police chief of Post Falls, Scott Hoag, we talked about, you know, the usual kind of expected questions about how they deal with suicide calls. But there were a couple highlights there, too. A, he runs a special program where he actually, when they go to a suicide call, they do follow-up. They send a chaplain from the police department out to counsel these people. It's a really unique program. So that was interesting. And then he also shared with us something that was almost shocking. He talked about the suicide rate for police officers, and it was extremely high. And I, you know, I didn't realize that. And so that was another kind of interesting bit, too. One of the other panelists was from a support group who's actually for those who've lost loved ones to suicide. She herself has lost someone to suicide in her family. Her name's Cheryl Shepherd. She's actually with hospice, so she's used to dealing with some kind of touchy things. She had this really remarkable segment where she described, in essence, how people should deal with grief, but more specifically, how to talk to somebody who's lost a loved one to suicide, and that was really moving.
Steve Jackson was the moderator of Spokane Public Radio's Suicide Awareness Forum Wednesday night at Spokane City Hall. The forum was recorded for later broadcast next week on KSFC and our sister station KPBX and on our partner, Spokane City Cable 5. You can listen here on KSFC Sunday at noon, Tuesday at 10 p.m., and next Thursday at 11 a.m. Or you can go to SpokanePublicRadio.org for more specific dates and times. Last Saturday, Spokane's Episcopal Diocese installed its first female bishop. Gretchen Reberg is a Pullman native who went back east to go to college. She earned a Ph.D. in organic chemistry and taught at Bucknell University in Pennsylvania. But eventually, the call for a religious vocation took her away from academia. She went to New York City and studied to be a priest. She was ordained and served her first parish in York, Pennsylvania. But in 2005, she heeded another call, this time to come back to the Northwest, closer to family. So she went to work at the Episcopal Church in Lewiston, Idaho. And last fall, she heard that Spokane's Episcopal Bishop, James Wagoner, was going to retire. And so she applied. So what's the process in the Episcopal Church to become a bishop? I was born and raised Catholic, and then the Pope makes all the decisions about how you move up in the hierarchy. How does it work in the Episcopalian Church?
Yeah, so I think the Roman Catholics have it a little easier. So the Episcopal Church comes out of the Church of England, and so when the Revolutionary War happened, the people who said, how do we now govern ourselves if we're no longer the Church of England, were in many ways the same people who were saying, how does this new country govern itself? And so we have an election process. And we have sort of two houses, the house of the laity and the house of the clergy, and they have to agree with each other. And so when the bishop announces he's retiring, there's a call for nominations. And the diocese says, here's who we are, here's what we're looking for, who is out there that might fit that? And people are nominated. So people say, here's a priest who we think would make a good bishop for this diocese at this time. And if you're nominated, you're asked, okay, are you willing to accept that nomination? And if you accept it, then there's a whole process of people looking at your skills and gifts and looking at the skills and gifts needed for the diocese and saying, is this a match? And then you come up with usually 3 to 5. In our case, we had 4 candidates. And we have what we call the walkabout process, where you literally go throughout the diocese and people have a chance to get to know you and ask you questions and try to ascertain and discern, seek the prayer and guidance of the Holy Spirit to say, would this person be the bishop God wants in this diocese? And then there's an election, and the clergy and the laity have to agree. And it can take multiple ballots, as it did in my case.
For those who aren't Episcopalian, but they ask you, what's it all about? How do you explain your church to people from the outside?
Right, so we've started talking about the Episcopal Church as the Episcopal branch of the Jesus movement, which is our presiding bishop's phrase, which I actually really like, because what it reminds us is that the whole point of this is to follow Jesus. And we do it in our own way, and we do it in a way that has developed over the years with our traditions and our understanding. The Episcopal Church sees itself in many ways as the middle way between the Catholics and the Protestants. We're not a true Protestant church, for instance, but we're not Roman Catholic, we're not Eastern Orthodox, we're part of the Anglican tradition. We come out of the Church of England. And we really believe a variety of things, including that God loves everybody. Everybody's welcome. Everybody's invited to follow Jesus. And what we're called to do is follow Jesus together. And we will work with anyone who wants to work with us as we follow Jesus together. And you don't even have to believe in Jesus to follow Jesus, right? Because Jesus said, go out and feed the hungry and house the homeless and clothe the naked and take care of the stranger and orphan and widow and love your neighbor. And if you're doing that, you're following Jesus, period, in my mind. And we're called to do that together. And that's what the Episcopal Church is all about.
The Catholic Church has the Pope, and the Pope sort of sets the tone. And you know, especially with the new Pope, Pope Francis, it's sort of gone a different direction. Who leads the Episcopalian?
Yeah, we don't have one leader unless that would be Christ himself, right? So we have bishops, and in the diocese, the bishop is considered the chief pastor. We have the American Church, the presiding bishop, and that's the bishop who presides over the House of Bishops, and he or she really does set the tone for the bishops and is the public face of the church. But in many ways, I would actually say the people who lead the church are the people in the pews, because they're the ones who are dedicated, showing up, doing the work, following Christ. And you know, without the laity, the people in the pews, the ones who are every day in, day out, trying to do the work of God, nothing's going to happen. So I would say the real leaders of the church are the people in the pews.
So with the current political tenor of our country right now, is that tearing at the fabric of your faith group?
I don't think it is. I think sometimes we tend to be very polite. And if there's a tension, we might not talk about it as much as we should. Because, for instance, if we just think about, let's just take health care. I don't know the best way to accomplish health care in this country. What I do know is Jesus healed the sick. And so as a leader in the faith, what I can say is, look, I don't know the best way. And good political minds, good economic minds, good medical minds can debate that. But what we should not debate, I say, as now a bishop, is that we're called to heal people. And I think when we approach it that way, and we can lower the level of the tone of the debate by saying, can we agree on some basics? Jesus called us to heal people. Then that really helps. I think that's where the church can actually serve the community really well, by bringing disparate voices together and saying, can we agree on some basic principles, some basic moral principles, some basic principles of how we live as a community? And then agree that maybe we have different ways of accomplishing that goal. But if we start off by debating the different ways, we just stay in debate.
Gretchen Rehberg is the new bishop for the Episcopal Diocese of Spokane. She's the spiritual leader now for 36 churches in eastern Washington and northern Idaho. You can hear my story about her ordination ceremony at the SPR website. Click on the Regional News tab. You're listening to the Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio, and this sounds like a bunch of angry insects, doesn't it? Well, these are three small drones chasing each other around an enclosed area in a Spokane Convention Center ballroom. The venue was a conference held Tuesday, sponsored by the Spokane Association of Realtors, and the guys flying these little machines made them themselves, mostly for fun. But there are commercial applications for drones as well. Joseph Williams pays attention to that. He works in the Washington State Office of Economic Development and Competitiveness, and he came over from Olympia for the drone conference. What's the public perception of what drones are versus the possibilities, the potentials of drones?
Well, there have been some bad drone stories. The Space Needle's been hit twice. Some poor woman was hit by a drone, and the drone operator was sentenced to jail. So there's been negative publicity. But the positive benefits... drones are very important in agriculture. Drones are very important in infrastructure inspection. Drones are very important for real estate and anything involving commercial photography. Drone videos of weddings are amazingly hot all over the world. But drones are also important for delivering things like supplies or dealing with first responder issues. Drones are also important, as we'll see, as Amazon unfolds its offerings around delivering goods and services.
So some of those are intuitive to me, but you said drones are important in agriculture. How's that?
So a lot of drones are being used for sweeping the farm in order to do infrared analysis of soils, insect concentration, things like that. There are uses of drones for finding livestock. The uses of drones for actually charting how well the crops are doing and planning harvests and things like that. So ag drones are very hot right now.
So you're as we talk about legislation, it's talking about growing a new industry, and I'm thinking the pot industry is not quite the same parallel, but we're growing a pot industry in the state of Washington. How's the drone industry growing? What's the state of the legislation to regulate it?
Well, let me first talk about the drone economy. So we have everything from drone manufacturers who make Predator-type drones that are used in military to fly-free systems, which makes drones that actually carry movie cameras that are used in large-scale movies. So part of the drone economy is manufacturers of these vehicles. Part of the economy is what are people doing with these. The with these part has a lot of privacy concerns. So drones are flying over my property. They're looking at me. They're looking at my good, you know, what I have around the house. It makes me a little nervous. And so the legislation that's been popping up has been a reaction to that.
So as you, with the Department of Commerce, how do you conceive of a drone industry growing in Washington?
Well, what we're trying to do, we have the Unmanned Systems Industry Council, which was formed last year, which is designed to promote economic growth in the drone sector. And what we're looking for is making sure we don't have legislation that inhibits that, so it's sort of a reactive group, but it's also a promotive group. What do we need to do to produce college graduates who can go into this industry? What's the skill set? Or out of the community colleges. We're also interested in, are there tax credits, perhaps, that can be used? Not in this legislative session, but perhaps in future legislative sessions. We're also looking at how do we get a cluster? How do we bring all these companies together so they can share ideas, potentially share talent, and grow what we do in this sector? My primary concern right now is in agriculture drones. I think we're falling behind some of the other states, and I think we need to be more aggressive in working with University of Washington, Washington State University, and the regional colleges in looking at how these drones are going to impact agriculture, because they are. And we don't want to be behind Idaho, North Dakota, and Colorado.
Well, Spokane Fancies itself is growing an aerospace industry on a much smaller scale than what Seattle has. Do you see drones being a part of that?
Absolutely. In fact, X-Craft, which is currently out of Coeur d'Alene, that would be a great company to attract to the Spokane area because they would help incubate the rest of the industry. The best part of what's happening in Spokane is there's a great amount of interest in the technology, and so what needs to follow then is be some kind of investment capital saying, let's make a go of this. Doesn't require huge manufacturing resources in order to make this happen, and so there's a lot of potential here.
Joseph Williams is the lead for the Washington Governor's Information Communication Technology Sector. You can hear our full interview at the Spokane Public Radio website. Click on the Regional News tab. Inland Journal is a new weekly public affairs program produced at Spokane Public Radio. You can find the program and some of its pieces online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Join us next time, same time, same place.